Join us on the What's in Your Head podcast on May 13th as we interview Danny Boone, the founding member of the music group Rehab. Welcome to my head. I'm elated that you made it. Excuse the mess. I'm mentally constipated, agitated, and aggravated. I know you're probably thinking, what in the 665 demons per brain cell in Danny's skull is going on? Celebrated artists under Average Joe Records and solo artists. Also joining him is the multi-talented Brad Darnell, not only the official photographer for Rehab, but also the co-host of the WRBN podcast. Join us on the What's in Your Head podcast on May 13th. Digital 410 Media proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Don Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Dennis Blocker.
What's up, everybody? Before the show, I just want to bring your attention to a worthwhile cause. Something cool that's going on. Our friend Christoph over on Facebook has started a GoFundMe. He wants to put up two memorial plaques for the 398th Bomb Group in Lemke, Germany. There's a brief history on his GoFundMe page, which we have linked on our Facebook page, the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast page. But in his GoFundMe, he says on February 3rd, 1945, two American B-17s collided over Lemke, Germany. Both aircrafts were part of the 398th Bombing Group. Only three of the 18 men survived the terrible collision and subsequent crashes. One of them was killed later when the American fighter pilots attacked a POW column that he was part of because they thought they were German troops. The victims of both Powell's crew and McCormick's crew were buried in local cemeteries at Lemke until after the war. After the war, they were reburied in the United States Military Cemetery in Belgium, where three of them are still at rest. The others have been repatriated to the United States. With the money from this collection, he wants to fund two small commemorative plaques to remind us of this tragic incident. They will be hung at the entrance of the cemetery in Lemke and inaugurated in September in the presence of family members of several of the crew members of Powell's crew. So head over to WTSPWorldWar2.com for that link or go to our Facebook page. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II-based podcast. We have a very special guest tonight, and as always, joining us from Texas is Dennis Blocker. Jeff is out this evening because, well, he got the creepy cud from talking to Dennis and other people at the air show all weekend, but Jeff will be back next week, I am sure. But joining us tonight is author and executive producer from Inside Edition, Mr. Charles Lockman. Charles, how you doing tonight, sir?
Great. Thank you so much for having me. Really, really appreciate it.
I'm super excited to have you on. Looking at your background, this is your fifth book that we're going to talk about, which is Codename Nemo, The Hunt for the Nazi U-Boat and the Elusive Enigma Machine. And it's interesting how you came about this, but real quick, just because I'm an old radio guy and you're a TV guy, I'm very interested. Let's give our audience a real quick background on you. How did you get involved in radio? Did you were you in communications in college? Did you fall into it? I mean, not radio, but TV. Did you kind of fall into it? How did you end up working for Inside Edition?
Well, I'll give you the Reader's Digest version.
Sure.
I started off in print. My first job was in White Plains, New York. And then I went to your neck of the woods in Florida, Fort Lauderdale News, which doesn't exist anymore. Then I came back up north and worked for a number of years at the New York Post, and that got me into the Murdoch organization. He got into TV when he purchased what was then the Metro Media Station Group. Later, it became the Fox Station Group, and I went over there and started working in local news for Channel 5 in New York, and then. The folks at Inside Edition conducted a raiding party and snatched me away and as a managing editor. And then I became the executive producer in 1995. And guess what? I've been there ever since. So it's quite quite a run.
That is, that's a huge run. A lot of people who don't know the inner workings of media, whether it's TV, radio, or print, That amount of time at a single organization is tremendous. You and I were talking about before I came on the air, I used to be a producer for an afternoon show. Those two hosts are still together, but they started hosting their afternoon show on that radio station here in Fort Myers in 1997. And they've been on that same station and that team. Well, they went to mornings for a while after Howard left, but they've been on the same station working together all that time. And so to put in that much time for a single organization in media is a tremendous compliment to you and your skills.
Well, I like to say that every day at work is a challenge. Every day is kind of a war. Your energy level really needs to be really high to perform. And to me, it's as exciting as flying a jet plane, except you can't get killed.
True that. How did the subject matter of U-boats and Enigma machines come to your attention, and what motivated you to write a fantastic book, might I say? We're going to get into it, but I can't. Every single episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, we have a little segment called What You're Reading. And there's been a few times there's been some books that I've been reading for four or five episodes that are true slog. Your book, sir, is not one of them. It is an easy read. It grabs onto you, and it reads much like a TV show and or a movie. But we'll get into that here soon. But how did this come to you, and what motivated you to get into the subject matter?
Well, it was really a crazy set of circumstances, and so bizarre. I still can't believe it happened the way it happened. But yeah, I'd written, as you point out, this is my fifth book, but I'd written four books, and I was always searching for a great subject matter. The thing about a book is that you become obsessive with it. You have to really, really be willing to spend years working on this subject matter. So it better be of interest to you, and you better have the material to sustain that level of interest, especially for somebody like me. I've got more than a full-time job. Yeah. I'm putting in 12-hour, 13-14-hour hours a day. And you get home, you just want to go to sleep. But you got to be motivated enough to sit down and research and write. So I was kind of struggling, I have to be honest, and looking for a subject matter that suited my skills and my interest level. So lo and behold, it's Thanksgiving, and my wife and I head out to Chicago to visit our daughter, who at that time was working for News Nation as a TV reporter. And she was at that time living with her boyfriend, actually her fiance, and he wanted to, you know, keep the parents entertained. So he had this whole itinerary. And the big stop on his little tour of Chicago was the Museum of Science and Industry. And he said, "You got to see this U-boat exhibit." I said, "Huh, U-boat exhibit, really, in the museum? Well, that should be kind of interesting."
That was my question. We'll get to in a minute. How does a U-boat end up at a museum for science and industry? But I guess it's, but we'll get there, but go ahead.
That's part of the story. So we go in there, and they're assigned U-505 exhibit, follow this way. And I can't tell you the level of excitement I had as I follow the signs. And then suddenly you're in the basement of the museum, and there it is, staring at you. That is it, a giant U-boat, a German U-boat. And your first thought is, how the heck did they get this beast inside the basement of a museum in Chicago? How did that happen?
How did they get it through the streets of Chicago to get it into the
basement?
Well,
that's another story, right. So it actually was a book written about that very topic, just that single topic.
I imagine.
By the museum. So, you know, the museum tells a very compelling story of the background, and they have all the video components, and you take a tour of it. And the more I saw, the more I got worked up about it. I turned to my wife and I said, "This is the book. This is what I've been looking for." It hit me like that. And then you start doing go home, do the research, start kind of delving into the subject matter. And pretty quickly, I realized that it was definitely a book.
That's awesome.
How do you go about...
By the way, I should point out that my daughter's fiance, and she broke up. So the book worked out.
Hey, it's one of
the
those
relationship
things.
did not.
If it wouldn't have happened, this wouldn't have happened. So everything has a silver lining to it. Before we get a little into the details, just because Dennis and I have talked about this in the past with him doing research on books and some of our other authors, with you and your busy schedule, did you outsource some of your research? What were your some of your first steps in researching the actual story behind that sub? Did you reach out to some of the people at the museum? How did you go about, because you go into a tremendous, pun intended, I guess, deep dive into the background of not only the German soldiers on the U-boat, but the American soldiers on the three or four, the flat top plus the accompanying ships on some of these missions, the key players. You go into the background where they grew up, where they went to school, give a little brief synopsis of them as you introduce their characters into the roles in which they play in the capturing of this sub. How did you go about finding time to research that, and where do you start?
Well, that's a good question. The first thing that I had to do, that most authors I think do, is find out what has been written about this subject matter. And once you look into that, you find your niche. You have to, what can you contribute that advances the story, that tells the story in a different and unique way? And there have been books written about the capture of U-505, and not to in any way denigrate another author's work, but they were very kind of tech-driven. They were written for engineers, if you will,
sure,
U-boat aficionados, and no book was written for the general audience, and that's where I saw my route, my avenue. And the first thing I did was after looking into all the available research material in terms of books, is reach out to the museum. And and they were absolutely amazing. So they opened up their archives to me, and I flew out there back to Chicago and, to quote you, did a deep dive into the archives. There were dozens and dozens and dozens of cartons that had been donated to the museum by, later Rear Admiral Dan Gallery, and over the years, other people who were actively involved in the hunt for U-505, as well as the Germans who were captured in that operation, donated everything they had to the museum, which became
what a treasure trove
slash unofficial source for everything U-505. Now you open up these boxes, and you know the archivists are just, I don't know if you've met archivists before, but they are a dedicated bunch of people. They, you know, they wear gloves. They put everything in plastic. This information to them is precious, and they treat it that way. And as a researcher, you have to be respectful of that and treat it that way as well.
Absolutely.
Hours and hours of diving into this material, and then it was a gold mine. And the key richness of it was finding these primary source material interviews that the guys on the who were involved in the operation on the American side gave to the museum in 1999, and no one had ever used it.
Jeez.
So it was just sitting there waiting for somebody, me, come along and utilize that material. And then, amazingly enough, the Germans were also involved. The guys who were captured on the enemy side were into this subject matter as well. And they did interviews in German, some in English, who spoke English, and those were also donated to the museum.
My
there
gosh.
Are National Archives had a great source of material, the Navy Archives, but the key component for me was the Chicago Museum of Science and Industry.
That makes sense.
If I had that stuff, I wouldn't have done the book.
That makes sense on multiple levels, because we, Jeff and I, have discussed just on a micro level when friends, family, members of your community find out that you're in the World War II and you have a collection, things end up your way, whether it's books, family stuff that they had no longer. I've been given so many things. Jeff has been given so many things. So it makes sense that the facility that has the actual ship would start getting all this stuff. And as you know, and Dennis knows, for every artifact you see on display in a museum, there's 5,000 more in a box in the back that they don't have room to display. So it makes perfect sense that they would have all this content and for you to shine a light onto it and publish it. And you were talking about the archivist, and Dennis and I were talking about this a few episodes back. Archivists, they don't get enough credit because A, not only are they preserving this stuff, we were kind of joking around about how in the future we're going to have the lost art of people's ability to write, read cursive handwriting. But more importantly, which I suffered through, before the show, you and I were discussing, I interviewed a World War II vet, but my grandfather also fought over in European Theater of Operations. He worked in grave registration. And about 3 or 4 weeks ago, I had found, because I've done computers for 20 years, I have the same laptop case I've had forever. And about 10 years ago, my mom gave me some newspaper clippings that my grandmother pulled out on the 50th anniversary of D-Day. And she wrote in the columns and in pen some of the roles that my grandfather played. So here I am trying to read my own grandmother's handwriting. Not only is it in cursive, but everybody's handwriting is different. And I'm struggling to read my own grandmother's handwriting and make sense of some of the words. But that's what these archivists do. Not only are they adept at reading handwriting, but they can make out those little shorthands, those little swipe of a pen that makes a letter harder to read, and they can help interpret a lot of that stuff and categorize it. And it makes doing what you and Dennis has done in the past as far as researching his source material, you couldn't do it without these people. And they're like unsung heroes for history. They truly are.
They remind me of nurses, in effect. It's not so much an occupation, but a calling.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely.
That's really special to be an archivist.
Yeah, that's exactly true. Charles, I was up in Park Falls, Wisconsin, this really small library, and I had word that they had actual bound volumes of newspapers from the 1918, 1917, around the time period that my great-grandfather was in World War I. And I had this information. And so I go to the library and, you know, sure enough, the director is there and she is going to get me the microfilm. And there's just something about having the actual print in front of you. And I went up to her and she had these rolls in her hand of the microfilm. And I said, ma'am, I have information that you might actually have the originals. And I says, I need you to know that I'm very respectful and that I've been to the archives. I'd wear gloves. I said, these documents could not possibly be in better, safer hands. And I'm going to take care of them. And I just really am hoping that you would just grant me access. And she looks me up and down, and she's, you know, because she could see the gears turning in her head, and she just says, "All right, follow me." So we go up these creaky old steps, like up to the third floor, and she takes this. In my mind, it was a skeleton key, and she opens up this door, and there's like cobwebs, and sure enough, there's just like all these bound volumes, and because of the zeal that I exhibited, and she saw. She went ahead and just reserved the whole room for me for 3 days and just gave me just unlimited access. But I think that to your point, those archivists, they love what they do. And if they can see that same reciprocal love and for the content and for the work they've done and their respect, doors start opening. It's just amazing.
Got that right. Yep.
Yeah.
When you started producing the manuscript and the story outline for Codename Nemo, the hunt for the Nazi U-boat and the elusive Enigma machine, was there a particular person or character who kind of, with the source material that you had from the museum, was there a particular person who kind of, their story almost wrote itself because the content and the source material was so plentiful?
Well, I would have to immediately say Dan Gallery. He was the captain of the USS Guadalcanal, He came from Chicago, which is exactly why the U-boat ended up in Chicago, is the gallery family that arranged to have this incredible exhibit displayed in Chicago. But Dan Gallery was then a captain in the U.S. Navy. He came from a Irish-American family. His father was a lawyer. His mother was a writer for the Archdiocese of Chicago. One brother became a priest, and the three other gallery brothers joined the Navy. And actually, they were all rear admirals, which is the first in Navy history. So Dan Gallery was quite a character. He was not just he was a naval aviator. He was one of the first serve at sea and also to learn how to fly planes. So he was a natural commander to be named as the first captain of the USS Guadalcanal. And he was also a brilliant naval strategist. He was an innovator and he was a maverick. And he's the one who devised the operation, the plot, the scheme to capture a Nazi U-boat. It was all in his head. And by magic, brilliant planning, a lot of luck, and he managed to pull it off. He is an amazing character, and I'm delighted that the book is able to kind of bring him to a new generation of people or readers who never knew about his life.
Yeah, you pointed out in the book that when he got assigned to the USS Guadalcanal, this was a new type of flat-top carrier. This was considered a baby carrier. It was smaller than the normal size.
Right.
And he probably could have very easily got himself commissioned to a different type of vessel. But simply based on the name and the appreciation he had for the importance of the Battle of Guadalcanal, he's like, no, this is my ship. I'm going to take care of it. This is where I want to be. But to your point of proving his level of ingenuity, you pointed out in the book that he kind of brought forth the concept of nighttime flights off of baby carriers. That prior to him and the USS Guadalcanal, because nighttime missions, obviously out sea during the 40s, there's no light pollution, technology's just coming into its own. It's very dangerous to land a plane, let alone take off a plane from a full-size carrier, let alone a smaller one. And he made sure, he saw to it that every pilot on that vessel at some point got nighttime certified. Because as you pointed out in the book, and as people who may know or may not know, when submarines are submerged, they're running off of batteries. Now, these aren't lithium batteries that, you know, power our iPhones, my Garmin watch that will run for days. These are large old cell batteries that have a decent amount of life to them, but it's a limited, predictable life. And the only way to recharge them, much like our cars, is with the alternator. But you can't run a diesel engine underwater because you have nowhere for that exhaust to go. So at some point, the submarines are going to have to come to the surface, run on top for a few hours to recharge the batteries. And more often than not, due to security concerns, they did it at night. And so Gallery knew, hey, you know, we've been commissioned to go hunt U-boats. These guys are submerged throughout the day. If we're truly going to be effective at our mission, we're going to have to perfect nighttime flights off of many carriers.
Right. That was one of his great innovations. And it really did change the course of World War II, particularly in the Battle of the Atlantic. You know, Gallery is an interesting character. He started off when war broke out, he was assigned to command the U.S. Naval base in Iceland. And he didn't want to be in Iceland. He wanted to be in the Pacific. So he would be reading all these stories and hear the radio reports of these great historic battles taking place in the Pacific theater. And that's where he felt he was meant to be. So finally, he gets reassigned out of Iceland and is given command of the USS Guadalcanal, which he called his sweet ship. And it was, as you point out, one of the baby carriers, shorter than the Yorktown, But and it was built by Rosie the Riveter, and no one really knew because it was supposedly built on the cheap. It was supposed to kind of bring the sensibilities of the Ford Motor Company to aircraft carrier design and shipbuilding. So he's given this ship, and he couldn't be happy. And then, of course, the Navy drops the other shoe and assigns him not to the Pacific but to the Atlantic. And he was so disappointed, and maybe that's what triggered his brilliance, because he wanted to so make an impact on the war that it goosed him to create these, as you point out, the Knight certification. Every pilot on the Guadalcanal, he lost a lot of planes that way, not lives but planes. He was able to rescue, I think. All but just a handful of the pilots, but and it took a lot of hours, a lot of drama, but they were pretty soon certified for nighttime flying, which was essential in the Battle of the Atlantic. It changed the war, as you point out. U-boats no longer had the sanctuary of nighttime operations to roam about and do what they will. Now the fact that the aircraft carriers were brought to the Atlantic theater also changed the course of World War II. So a U-boat could be stricken at any point, anywhere in the Atlantic, thanks to Gallery and people like him.
I was just saying, it's kind of slightly reminiscent to Doolittle, right? Doolittle's trying to launch these B-45 Mitchells off a full-size carrier. They've got to cut weight. These planes were never designed for that short takeoff. And now you have planes that were designed for longer takeoffs on full-size carriers now being launched from a smaller carrier, which is fine, but doing that at night. And yes, they lost some planes, but kind of like Doolittle was doing, it was almost, as they saw, a necessary evil.
Charles, how was the buy-in from the flight crews, you know, with this new concept? Was it a hard sell, or how was the reception on this idea for the...
I think they were totally into it. They thought Gallery was a great commander, and they wanted to. These are motivated young men who were fearless. I mean, they were not reckless. They were just fearless in their desire to defeat Nazi Germany. And so everything that I've seen in the history books and the information I was able to dig up, they were totally supportive of his efforts.
Well, I think a lot of that had to do with his practice of leading by example.
Exactly.
Explain to our audience one of the ways he proved to the, because you were saying he was one of the few naval captains who also was a pilot. So right. He kind of proved his theory by doing it.
That, exactly. The Guadalcanal left the port in Washington State, and on its first cruise, shakedown cruise, went down the Pacific and docked in San Diego. And he was determined to be the first aviator to take flight off his aircraft carrier. So the planes were brought on board. The pilots were reported for duty. Gallery was absolutely set on being the first pilot to take off, and he did. And he landed the plane, and he proved that he not only talked a good game, but he walked the walk.
That's remarkable.
Yeah.
Now the lead character in this book obviously is U-505, and. An interesting, and you probably won't have the answer for this. Maybe Dennis will have a little insight into this. So U-505 at the time, it's a new ship. It's kind of the cream of the crop. It's leading on technology. And you so wonderfully explained that, okay, this crew's job is to go hunt. They're not hunting naval ships. Their job is to go after merchant ships. They want to sink the supply chain. They want to, you know, all the stuff with oil, the metals, everything, they ammunition, they're strictly going after supply chain. But in order to be out cruising for a long time, you need a lot of supply. And you pointed out the fact that they got a lot of eggs and they got a lot of food that they're going to eat on the front end of their cruise, right, get the eggs and all that stuff slowly out of the way. And then as they're going, some of the non-perishables will be consumed later. But what I found funny is storage on this vessel was at such a premium that they even loaded everything into the head, the bathroom, if you will, to the point where they were defecating in this bucket that comes to become a character in and of itself later. But what I didn't understand is if you have perishable items such as eggs and bread, the things you're going to consume on the front end, a lot of oranges and citrus, wouldn't you put that in the head first so that you can kind of consume a hole big enough so that you can start using the head instead of using the bucket first and then work your way back? But apparently they must have put some ammo and some, you know, hard storage in there. I would have put the perishables in there first so that we can clean that. That would be my priority. Let's clean that room out first and work our way back. But apparently not so much.
Well, I'm glad you weren't around to advise the German Navy on that.
Being 6 foot five, I probably wouldn't have any place in that vessel. They wouldn't have any room for me. One of the first event I did as a living historian, we have the SS American Victory. It's a Liberty ship in Tampa Bay, and it actually works, and they take it out on Tampa Bay. And as a living historian, they'll have a handful of us there in uniforms to give the public the ambiance. Being 6 foot five, just walking through a Liberty ship, I almost got a concussion four times a day. So there's no way I could fit in a submarine at all. But I just thought it was funny. It's like they're loading of this vessel. It's like you could have maybe only had to use that bucket for like 2 weeks, but who knows?
Well, life on board U-505 and the other U-boats in the German fleet, well, you had to be a dedicated German sailor to live through that. I mean, it was the stink, the combination of rotting food, human body waste, a body odor, the lack of fresh air, the bilge water, the stink from that. It was noxious. And what a relief to the men when the boat would surface, as you pointed out, to recharge or for whatever reason, also for fresh air. They had to literally air out the boat. And although they were cautious about getting on top of the deck because they were afraid of attacks by the British or U.S. or Allied plane, so only a handful. They called it, it was a smoke break. However long it took for you to finish a cigarette, you could stay on the deck and then you had to leave and get replaced by one of the other guys. But it was both a combination of science and art, the supply of the food in the U-boat. And you're right about the eggs. I think the figure, I was just looking it up in the book, was 2,000 eggs that was stored, and you had to eat them. Obviously, eggs are perishable, so they're all eating eggs for the first 2 weeks of their cruise. It reminded me of the scene from Cool Hand Luke, where you know you're just popping in these eggs and eggs and eggs, and after a while, you can't look at another egg again.
And props to you for having the class not to include in the book that odor. I mean, you got that many 50 men consuming that amount of eggs in a confined area. I'm sure that didn't add to the ambience too well. Obviously, we want to encourage people to go out and pick up Codename Nemo, The Hunt for the Nazi U-Boat, and The Elusive Enigma Machine. And so we're not going to give anything away. But during your writing of this, did you come across any source material or any statistics or even speculation on the amount or the impact that perhaps the French resistance had on some of these naval yards? Because as you pointed out, a lot of these submarines, these U-boats, reported to different ports throughout German-occupied France. And right. Obviously, when Germany has every able-bodied man out on the battlefield or on subs or on vessels, they relied heavily on forced labor, and in occupied France, that means, hey, we're going to use some of these young Frenchmen. And it may not have been proven, but there's parts in the book that was speculated that there may have been some saboteur going on. Did you come across anything that kind of maybe had some speculation of how much impact the French resistance may have had on failures on some of these U-boats?
Well, I think pretty considerable. U-505's home port was in the French seaport of Lorient. And the resistance, the French resistance, was very active in that port. And one of the second captain of U-505, Peter Zesch, he was just tormented by the resistance. He would bring his boat out, and within a matter of a few hundred yards, it would start gurgling, and there would be a water leak, and he would have to come back to port. They would find a dead cat or a dead dog in the water tank. He would see puncture wounds. The caulking had to be obviously very specialized. And then the boat was in the cork was an inferior quality, clear sabotage. It even came to the point that they executed a number of the members of a number of the dock workers who they suspected didn't prove but suspected were part of the resistance. The Germans, of course, did not necessarily need proof to put innocent people up against the wall. And then there was a time when the Gestapo actually boarded the U-505 and accused some of the German sailors of participating in the acts of sabotage. And the sailors said, "You got to be, are you kidding? Why would we try to commit suicide on this vessel? This is day the boat could sink to the bottom of the ocean. Yeah. We're not going to be." And they even the Gestapo was convinced that no, it had to. Be not the sailors on board U-505, but it had to be the members of the resistance.
Yeah, to that point, it's not a tank. If the thing breaks down, we're not just going to hop out and walk away. I mean, Right. Well, this is our lifeline out here. And you brought up the signs of scurvy. These guys would go out there, and their teeth would start to loosen up.
Right.
Now, when they went back for their repairs, sometimes it took weeks, and some cases when the sabotage, I think what you said, like total of 10 months that they were kind of right. Back and forth. During that time, when you start getting adequate amounts of protein, does that loosening of the teeth kind of reverse itself, or is it kind of once it sets in, you're just looking like a Canadian hockey team after a certain point?
I honestly don't know the answer to that. I don't know whether scurvy is a permanent or you can recover from it with a good diet. I'll have to look that one up.
Dennis, you spent some time around some sailors. You got the answer to that? How scurvy affects one? Is it long term? Is it easily reversible?
No, I think it's reversible, but I'm not. It's not my specialty, but yeah, I think it is reversible.
Yeah, I guess once you start getting enough protein, your gum, it's probably a result of the gums getting thin. I don't think it's probably as much right. as the roots of the teeth themselves. So I'm sure once the gums start to fatten up a little bit, it would definitely reverse that. In the book, too, we're not getting anything away. You briefly talk about some of the hazing or just poor treatment that some of these German sailors kind of discussed that they faced during boot camp. Did you come across a lot of that sort of source material when reading the content provided by the museum that you left out, or was it just something briefly that you read?
I kind of put everything I had in the book. So what you see in the book is pretty much everything. It's interesting how, like, every sailor is hazed. U.S. Navy, every national Navy sailors, when they cross the equator, you get hazed. It's just part of life. But I have to say, the German Navy took, in my opinion, particular delight in torturing their younger sailors, and I think this is part of the character. That led, frankly, to the capture of U-505, and maybe in the bigger picture, the Allied victory. It's yeah. the fascist / Nazi character that created dysfunction and abuse by the German commanders and to the lower level people. You didn't really get that in the U.S. Navy. You know, there was a camaraderie, and there was a camaraderie on U-505. I'm not denying that, but it was dysfunctional. It was a horrible. Even though they never forgot they were brave, the German sailors. They were devoted to their country. You know, their country. And looking back, it was inevitable that both Nazi Germany would lose the war and U-505 would end up the way it ended up.
This is more of a thought experiment, but reading the book and seeing the personalities of the three major captains who captained that vessel, do you think the outcome of U-505 would have been different if Olaf would have not been discharged from that sub?
I would have to say yes. Olaf Loh was the first commander of U-505, and he was relieved of command because of a blunder he committed when he blew up a yacht that happened to be owned by a diplomat from the nation of Colombia, and he, you know, he was a seafaring veteran. Everything that I've learned about him seems to indicate that he was no war criminal. He was a German U-boat captain who even though he was working for a repulsive regime and an evil philosophy, he was good to his men. He did not commit any war crime when his vessel blew up a merchant marine vessel. He did not machine gun down the survivors. He actually, in some cases, gave them food, told them how to get to the nearest body of land. So he behaved in a humane way, if you can say that a U-boat commander was humane. He was never a member of the Nazi Party, unlike the last captain of U-505. So I think, you know, he would have I think you're right that had he been in command of U-505, I'm not sure it would have ended the way it did.
Yeah, he kind of seemed like the German equivalent of some of those generals you read about from the South who weren't down for the cause. They were simply fighting for their land and their homes, and that they would be considered gentlemen and a scholar, that if they would just happen to have grown up north, they would have fought for the North. But since they grew up down South, they weren't fighting for the politics. They weren't fighting for to preserve slavery. They were simply fighting for their people and doing it in the most gentlemanly way possible. And out of those three captains, he definitely seemed to be the one who would be the old phrase, a gentleman and a scholar, opposed to the some of the other ones. Just seemed like they were out to make a name for themselves, and some of them just seemed to be, like, especially the second in charge, some of them just seemed to be, they just enjoyed it, the sadistic side of it.
He was the second commander, Peter Zesch, was a sadist. I tell one story about Hans Gobler, who was one of the key characters on the German side in the book, and how he was ordered to wake up one night while he was sleeping and get the second in command of U-505 a cup of water. And he got to the tower and handed him the cup of water. And as he was heading down to go back to sleep, the captain poured the scalding hot water over his head. I mean, come on. And then he got him another cup of coffee. He said, don't give me this bilge water. Give me a good cup of coffee. So he went back to the galley and got his friend to get him another cup of coffee. And, of course, heading up the ladder, what did he do? He spit in the coffee and handed it to the captain. The captain drank it. Said, now that's more like it.
As he was instructed to do by the head chef in the gallery. So,
right.
So he was following orders. He was
in a sense, right. But Peter Zesch was he had no business running he was the youngest U-boat commander in the German Navy. And I don't want to give anything away either. But, how he ended his days is just really, really extraordinary. That I guess I can say it. I mean, it's such a key component of the book. He became the first German naval officer to commit suicide during battle, and really quite an extraordinary event.
Wow.
As you pointed out earlier, Gallery took it upon himself, which to me seems very not common. Maybe I'm wrong. You would think a plan of this magnitude would at least need to go through, I don't know, 15 chains of command to get approval, not just him and his buddy at the 10th Navy?
Right. Well, the 10th Fleet.
The 10th Fleet.
The mysterious, the Phantom Fleet, as it was called, a fleet that had no aircraft carrier, no boat, not even a rowboat. Not a PT boat, nothing. It was
not even a paper boat. Are you familiar with the 10th Fleet, Dennis?
No, I'm not familiar with that fleet at all.
Go ahead, Charles.
Well, it was basically conceived by Fleet Admiral Ernest King, who was the number one guy in the U.S. Navy during World War II, and he decided to bring together all the components of intelligence regarding U-boats into the 10th Fleet. And it was a secret fleet. Everyone, every schoolboy and girl in America knew the fleets 1 through 7 in World War II. It was just, you know, that was just, you know, like reading the Pledge of Allegiance. Everyone knows this. But no one knew about the 10th Fleet, its existence. But Admiral King created it to bring it all under one roof, all the intelligence coming into the U.S. Navy regarding the U-boat menace, which was so considerable and potentially the thing that could end the war for the Allies. So he was determined to create this umbrella service, and it was proven to be very effective.
Charles, are those records for the 10th Fleet? Are they at College Park, Maryland, at the archives, or where are they located?
U.S. Navy Academy and archives. Yes, and right.
Yeah. Okay. Can I ask you a question about your writing process?
Sure.
When you were doing all the research, were you able to uncover something from the archive that you were able to get your hands on? Did you come across items that maybe the families didn't even know about their relatives, and were able to share some nuggets with the family, with the different people involved?
Well, that's a good question. The what I found was that the children of the nine volunteer sailors, U.S. sailors, who were members of the raiding party that actually captured U-505. They were, and I admire them so much because they carry on the legacy. Mm-hmm. They want to know everything there is to know about U-505 and what their dads did to change the course of the war. So when they were little kids, they were kind of introduced to, hey, your father was a hero. Here's his medal. Here's the Silver Star. Here's the Navy Cross. And then they would go to Chicago to see the U-505 exhibit. And the families would join the nine sailors on their regular treks to Chicago. Every 10 years, they had a reunion of the Guadalcanal and the Pillsbury members of the raiding party, and they would be joined by some of the Germans too, who came who actually moved to America after the war.
That's
so
wild.
That legacy is carried on into the grandchildren. They're so into this subject matter, I can't tell you. And it was a pleasure for me to reach out to them to say, hey, here I am. Here's my name. I'm writing this book about U-505. Oh, yappity, yappity, yappity. They were so happy to contribute whatever they could to helping me in the research that they just were so welcoming and generous with their, and they gave me everything that they had. For instance, there was one great character who I just came to appreciate so much, Wayne Pickles, who was a high school quarterback hero at the Alamo High School in Texas. And he was a member of the U.S. was a sailor on the USS Pillsbury and a key player in this whole drama. And he kept a diary, as a lot of guys did during the war. And the family gave me access to the diary. And it's this remarkable young man. He was just a kid. He just graduated high school, writing about, you know, going to Casablanca and being involved in Israel. And he started off, you know, painting the sides of the rest of the USS Pillsbury. And then by 1944, he was on this raiding party and writing about it in his diary. It was history come to life when they gave me that. And I was so anxious about just taking possession of it.
Yes.
So worried about losing it. And you pointed out the gloves and how the archivists are so dedicated to preserving this material. I was in a state of total panic when they sent it to me, and when I sent it back, I said, I'll make copies of it. I'll send it right back. I promise you'll have it in 48 hours. I put it in so much bubble wrap that it could have floated back down to Texas, where they live. So,
how nerve-wracking is that to know that it's in UPS's hands now?
It's not comforting at all.
I can imagine.
It's terrifying still, because you're just praying that the people along the route show just as much attention to detail as you do. And so, until you hear the family say "Thank you so much, we got it," you're terrified.
Yeah, they did. They did say that. And then, by the way, they said, "What do you want me to do with all this bubble wrap?"
Give it to your grandkids, obviously.
Oh, my goodness. One of my favorite parts of writing a book is the research. And I just get such satisfaction out of those little nuggets that I get from just the most obscure places. And it's hard to describe adequately, but you'll get a little nugget from a diary or from the back of a photograph that will have a date on it with somebody's name. And what I would tell families is like, look, you've been looking at this stuff forever, but I'm telling you, if you'll just send me or copy everything you've got, no matter how innocuous, no matter how mundane you think it is, it could be a wrapper from, it could be a napkin from a nightclub that's got a name on it, mm-hmm. that is another little nugget that shows where they went when they were off duty. They went to the nightclub in San Francisco. And, you know, it's one of my favorite parts. And then creating the timeline, starting to plug in all of the different nuggets into the timeline. And you start to see that go from when you first open it up and you put timeline and you enter 1942. And then from then on, it's just on. And ever you just start plugging in all this great stuff that you find and you see it grow and grow and grow. It's just so satisfying. And
yeah. Well, one of the interesting things that you remind me of just now is I was obsessed with learning more about this Lieutenant Albert David, who became the only recipient of the Congressional Medal of Honor in the Battle of the Atlantic. He led the nine-man raiding party that seized U-505. And as I say, he got the Medal of Honor. What an achievement.
Yes.
His life story comes to a tragic end in 1945. Can you imagine this? He goes through this. He wins he's awarded the Medal of Honor. He is sent back to the U.S. He's going to be given the medal by President Harry Truman on the lawn of the White House. And 2 weeks before he's going to be given it, he dies of a massive heart attack.
My gosh.
And really such a sad story. But I was determined to find, well, you know, I need more stuff on him.
Yeah.
I mean, I have basics. Who was he? Who are his descendants?
Right.
What happened to them? Do they even know this story? So I did, you know, the research that I do. And the it was incredible. They named a U.S. a warship after in his honor in the 1960s. So they sent the U.S. Navy sent a press release to his hometown newspaper in Missouri, and the editor of the hometown newspaper. This is a small town. I mean, I did a lot of research in that small town because I was desperate to find his family members. The editor of the newspaper had never heard of him before. In the early 60s, right? It wasn't too far after World War II.
Sure.
Well, what happened was that Lieutenant David had joined the Navy when he was a 17-year-old kid in 1919, and he was a lifer. He was in there for right up until his death in 1945. So he had no family left in his small town in Missouri, and there was no one really to tell his story. And it was really it was both it was sad and poignant. I thought that there was no one who knew about his legacy, his name. So that was one of the pleasures of my book in kind of bringing this guy's heroism to a new generation of people who had no idea he even lived.
Wow, that's phenomenal,
Dennis.
That's
this may
so
be,
rewarding,
Dennis. This may be something you can help answer. We're talking about the 9-man raiding crew. Now, obviously, we've discussed on previous shows, the Navy had the frogmen, you had some of the LCI guys, the PT cruiser boat guys. They kind of did a lot more of the close-up fighting. Your normal run-of-the-mill swabby, your normal Navy crewman, when they go through boot camp or their training, do they have a lot of training when it comes to small arms and boarding crafts? I mean, how uncommon is it for a chief engineer to go around a vessel saying, hey, I need 9 volunteers. I have explicit jobs each one is going to have to do. How does one make those decisions? And how do you trust that, you know, obviously you're going to need a mechanic, this and that, but you're going to need someone, at least the first two people going down that ladder with a Thompson, they're going to need to know how to control a situation and pull that trigger. Do a regular run-of-the-mill Navy swabbies, at least in World War II, have that sort of training where they're going to be proficient enough to do that?
But yeah, Charles, what did you learn about
that? Well, no, I was asking.
As far as my knowledge from the LCI gunboats in the Pacific, you know, they had UDT frogmen and they had Marines, and they had been through the marshals. And so they had done a lot of operations in conjunction with the 22nd Marines. But, you know, and then when they were at Saipan and they were boarding these Japanese half submerged vessels and they were doing room to room combat, I mean, this was not something that had been taught in naval boot camp, and they had fired rifles, but that was it. I mean, they never thought that they would be boarding. And so I'm really curious, Charles, like, did they do some, you know, they do some drills? Like, how did they?
Yes, they did. They were Lieutenant David, the officer who I mentioned was the head of the raiding party, and it was his job after he was named the head of the mission to find 8 other sailors who fit a certain caliber that he, or a certain skill that he was looking for. So he had two muscles, right? He had two guys armed with Tommy guns, and he had a guy who knew engines, and he had somebody who they were all trained. They had 3 weeks of training prior to the launch of the raid. So they set out in March of 1944. On the cruise, and for the next X number of weeks, they met on a pretty regular basis on the fantail of the USS Pillsbury, and the basic training was in boarding the whaleboat. It was key to the speed of the operation. They had to figure out how to get all their gear and equipment on board the whaleboat, climb on board, lower it, and head off to the U-boat, and that was their main training. But and they were given blueprints and told your job is to do this and this and this, this and this and this, And no one could understand what it was that they were going to do, because it was all on paper, and no one had ever been on board a submarine before, let alone a Nazi submarine. Mm-hmm. And they knew it was, but you know what they had? They had a great skill with tools. These are guys who, there was not a college educated guy in among the nine of them. But they knew tools. They knew how to work with their hands. They knew how to be innovators, and they also were patriots, and they had a mission, and they were very brave, and they were also young. So you have that advantage. But they each had a certain. They were told to look for the Enigma machine and given a sense of what that looked like. And another guy was told to. They each had a certain set of duties. One guy was assigned to. To break open the captain's cabin and pry open the safe, because he was told that's where the treasure is. That's where a lot of the secret code books would be stored. So he was assigned to that. So he was given a crowbar to carry on board with him. And another guy was the signal man, and he was the one who communicated with. He stood on the conning tower and would peer down into the hatch, and they would yell out at him what was going on, and he would communicate with Captain Gallery on the USS Guadalcanal and fill him in on all that was happening in the
remarkable
time that they had to wow. salvage the boat.
That's remarkable. Such courage. I mean, they had to know that the Germans were probably going to try and sink it. So they just had to just pretty much be and make peace with God before they went.
That's exactly what they did. They were told that, it was likely that the Germans were still on board, even though most of the Germans had abandoned ship. You could see them on the life raft, and they were begging to be rescued. They were in the open sea. The whaleboat proceeded on to the mission to U-505, where they boarded, and they went down the hatch. But before they fully suspected there to be a shoot 'em up inside the U-boat. And not only that, they were told through Navy intelligence that there were at least 14 detonation charges scattered around the U-boat, and that in all likelihood, the Germans who had abandoned ship had set them to explode within 15 minutes. And not only that, they expected as they went down the ladder of the hatch that perhaps the ladder itself would trigger a booby trap, and they'd be blown to bits. So the fact that they weren't, and they were able to secure the boat without suffering a single fatality, is really remarkable.
Wow. That's amazing.
The name of the book, Codename Nemo, The Hunt for the Nazi U-Boat and the Elusive Enigma Machine.
Billy Brown, the smoothest, coolest guy in town. The chicks all seem to dig his jive.
Hey, tell us, Bill, how can we arrive?
It's easy, Jack. Any gal gets sent when you flash a smile by Pepsodent.
You'll wonder where the yellow went when you brush your teeth with Pepsodent.
Pepsodent's new improved formula cleans teeth whiter than ever. Tastes brighter, too. New formula Pepsodent contains IMP. There's nothing else as good at getting teeth white.
You'll wonder where the yellow went when you brush your teeth with Pepsodent.
And I just want to give a quick shout out to Anthony Leota over at WLVN 1940s Radio. Look, if you guys are sitting around your office, you're at work, you're hanging out in your den and home, looking at all your World War II gear, you're driving down the street, you're at a World War II reenactment, sitting in your tent, whatever it is, if you want to listen to real-time 1940s radio, head over to WLVN1940sradio.com or download their app. Listen to it live, stream it live. It is like a real-life radio station, but set back in the 1940s. So, for example, as the time of this recording, it's May 2nd. I could go on their website right now, and he has an entire day scheduled out for May 2nd, 1943 or 1944, depending on where they're at in their timeline. But each day you'll hear different news reports. Sometimes you'll hear baseball games. You'll hear 1940s era music in a playlist, just like if you went out to your car and turned on the radio. Check it out. It's a great station. We love what they're doing over there, and they provide us with great music to use on our podcast. So head over to WLVN 1940s Radio and check them out.
Do you like that? Do you like that? that Pepsi Cola. It's the pot to 12 ounces. That's a lot of twice as much for a nickel, too. Pepsi Cola is the drink for you. Nickel, 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 nickel.
Pepsi Cola hits the spot. 12 full ounces, that's a lot. Twice as much for a nickel, too. Pepsi Cola is the drink for you.
Charles, thank you so much. Where can people reach out to you and find you at? And if they want to acquire more information about your book and where they can purchase it, where can they acquire that information, sir?
Well, it's all they have to do is put in code name Nemo, and you'll find it on any on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Powell Books, Books a Million, every book seller out there. And if they want to communicate with me, they could go to my website, charleslachman.com. It's Charles, L-A-C-H-M-A-N.com. And always happy to hear from readers. And I hope they buy it. I hope they read it. And I hope they enjoy it, because I think it's a really important story.
We have done a lot of books on this podcast, and we've gotten feedback from a lot of our listeners who do read the same books, but we've done very few on submarine and Navy. And as I was telling you off the air, this is a great book. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, this isn't one of these books I'm slogging through. I mean, I got it a little over a week ago and I'm almost done with it. It's a great book. It reads much like, I don't want to say like a screenplay, but it reads as if you're watching a TV show or a movie. It flows. You can picture it in your mind. All the information's there. All the character development's there. I didn't want to bring this up earlier because I didn't want to get bogged down into it. This book is what U571 wanted to be. We think that movie probably used this as source material, but was not the same story. That's what U571 wanted to be. But real quick, before we let you go, I just want to put this out there. For any of you all want to know what it's like to sleep on a submarine, fun fact, Manitowoc, Wisconsin, make history when you spend the night on the USS Cobia, a fully restored World War II submarine that is operating as an Airbnb. That's right. The Wisconsin Maritime Museum has been home of the USS Cobia for 50 years. Founded as a submarine memorial in 1969, we've grown to be the state's maritime museum and exhibits of shipwrecks, model cars, and more. But you can actually spend the night on a World War II sub. So if you want to know what it's like to sleep on a rack in a steel can, you can. And I've seen videos on TikTok. It looks good time. So if anybody's in Wisconsin and you want to rack out on a World War II cot, head on over to the head over on to Manitowoc, Wisconsin, and book you a. I would do it if I was in Wisconsin, especially as a World War II reenactor. I would love to spend the night on that on a vessel like that.
Heck yeah,
Charles! Thank you so much for your time. I can't say again how great this book is. I'm looking forward to finishing it up. I was reading it every night this week, yeah, preparing for you here to come on the show. It's a great read. It's a great book, and you learn a lot. There's so much we intentionally did not go over tonight because we don't want to give all the spoilers away. Some might say U-505 was sailing under a dark cloud because it definitely had a run of bad luck. And as I said earlier, if Olaf was not relieved, it may have ended a little differently for that sub. But thank you so much, sir. And we want to thank everyone for listening to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast. And we're going to skip what you're reading because you know what we're reading. We're reading Codename Nemo. We want to hear from you guys. Send us an email to mail@wtspworldwar2.com. And while you're on your computer and listening to this podcast, head over to wtspworldwar2.com. Click on the Patreon link, sign up and subscribe. Head over to wtspworldwar2 and click on a YouTube link. Watch all our YouTube videos. Go a long way to help support what we do here. Thank you guys so much. For myself, Charles, and Dennis, we will talk to you all next week.
This has been a Digital 410 production.